And tomorrow evening on Radio 4, we begin a new book at bedtime, Metamorphoses by Franz Kafka.
One morning, Gregor Zamza awoke and was surprised to notice he had turned into a beetle. Oh, well, he thought, that's what you have to expect if you work at Aldermaston.
That's at 10:15 tomorrow evening on Radio 4. But now...
It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. In tonight's show, we look at your legal problems. For instance, if you're charged with assault, which of the available options should you plead? Guilty, not guilty, or manager of Nottingham Forest?
And we'll also be talking to the Islamic Welsh nationalist who sets fire to cottages with copies of the Satanic Verses. But we're especially thrilled tonight, listeners, because we've been chosen as the first BBC programme ever to go out in a European edition ready for the lifting of trade barriers in 1992.
Also tonight we have Leon Britton in the
Aussi
studio.
Aussi ce soir nous avons dans le studio Monsieur Leon Britton.
And he'll be taking...
Wir werden auch heute Abend im Studio ein Besprech mit Leon Britton halten.
Look, Nick, is it necessary to translate everything I say?
Voyons, Nick, est-il nécessaire de traduire tout ce que je dis?
God, how many languages are you going to be translating the show into?
13. 13, 13, 30. Basically all the major European languages, you see, except for Dutch. Because that would involve Sharon in the first row in Flan, you know. Hot for dumb stuff, you know, you can't be doing with that.
This is absurd.
I don't say that, Andy.
Well, why not?
I don't know the Italian for absurd. That's probably absurdo or something. Look, it's okay, go ahead.
Really
absurdo!
Do we really need all this multilingual stuff?
Yeah, of course, we've got to be ready for 1992.
Well, what exactly is all this 1992? Anyway.
It's a superb business opportunity for British products.
Is it?
Yes. There's going to be an unrestricted flow of goods and people between us and the rest of Europe.
All right.
European markets are going to be wide open to us, and similarly, our markets will be made totally open to the Europeans.
Right, except the French, of course.
No, including the French.
Including the French? You can't be serious.
Of course the French will want to sell to our markets, and with the Channel Tunnel, it'll be a lot easier for them as well.
Well, why?
Well, the French will be able to reach England in 20 minutes, won't they?
You mean the French will be allowed to use the Channel Tunnel as well? I thought it was just for us.
No.
Has this been made public? Has it been made clear to everybody that 1992 means we'll be swamped by thousands of onion sellers on bikes, ringing our doorbells and sleeping with our women? Has it?
Andy, so we're with you. You're going to have to learn to be a little less chauvinistic. 1992 is going to mean lots of Europeans coming here. French, Dutch, Germans.
Germans? Nobody mentioned Germans, Nick. Now, I've watched all those TV ads with Bruce Oldfield and Mary Quant, and not once do they mention the Germans. I'm sorry.
Well, what do you want them to say? 1992 is a marvellous business opportunity, but it does entail being nice to Germans.
Exactly. The perfect wording. Yeah, yeah. Or better still, 1992. A great opportunity, but watch out for the Krauts.
You're so offensively insular. You really are.
I'm not insular. Ask anyone in my part of Putney.
Let's just change the subject, OK? I really just can't cope with the sheer power of your intellectual reasoning.
Well, that's understandable, Nick, yeah.
You had a good week, then?
Yeah, we had some very good news, actually. My brother, Dave, he's been made manager of Newcastle United Football Club.
But he knows nothing about football.
So?
Why has he been made manager of Newcastle?
It was his turn. It's an alphabetical rota, apparently.
How's he getting on, then?
A few problems with morale, you know. He was telling me they had this midweek game, and he went into the dressing room at half-time to do the pep talk.
Yeah.
All right. Two goals down at half-time, not the end of the world. Now, remember, if we can come back and win this, we get to the semi-finals of the Simod Cup. Look, can we all please stop giggling every time I say the word Simod Cup? Stop it!
Well, it's silly, isn't it? Simod Cup.
Yeah, it's embarrassing even to be in it. Why don't they give it its proper name? The Boring Cup, for teams not good enough to win anything else cup.
What is a Simod, anyway?
Well, it was in Call My Bluff last week. It's a sheep's testicle, I think.
Quiet,
quiet.
No, it's a Babylonian nose flute.
No.
Quiet! Listen, now, let's work out what went wrong in the first half. Now, the first goal, Barry, he was clean through, and you didn't tackle him. Why not?
Well, boss, see, if I mistime the tackle, I might have hurt him.
Yeah.
And then I might get sued.
Sued?
Yeah, civil action. He'd take me for the lot, the BMW, the Mock Tudor mansion.
And the solicitor's fees are
up. This is what's wrong with this bloody team. You've all become money mad, greedy, grab. Gary, are you listening?
Sorry, boss, just phoning my broker. Gold's down.
Oh, no. Look,
quiet. Oh, and Gary, no more mobile phones on the pitch, please, OK? Makes the fans feel you're not trying, OK? Oh, and Steve?
Yeah?
You're looking dreadfully slow on the wing.
Well, it's because I'm carrying an injury.
It's because you're carrying a sandwich board.
They're in a lot of trouble, though, aren't they, you know, Newcastle United?
Yeah, I saw them last week, and the goalie conceded one silly goal because he was on the phone to the Samaritans.
Yeah, let's face it, Newcastle out of soccer. What, England out of football?
Yeah. What do you think of the latest England squad?
I think the defence needs strengthening. I mean, it's going to be a tough game, isn't it? But I think we should win.
Oh, I don't know, you know. As Bobby Robson was saying on TV last night, you know, never underestimate Lapland.
I went to Lapland once, you know.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was the best holiday I've had since that sheep spotting weekend in North Wales.
Sheep spotting?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Well, it is for North Wales, yeah. But Lapland was better. It was terrific, it really was. We went all over the
place. What's the scenery like there?
Well, it was December, so we couldn't see anything because there's no sunlight in winter, you see. And when you get off the coach, you have to wear these big anoraks with great big hoods to protect yourself from the cold.
So it's really cold then?
Don't know, I had the hood on, see, so that's fine. But it was very interesting. The big letdown was not meeting Father Christmas, really. See, I've been down the pub one night talking to this bloke I know vaguely. Anyway, he was organising this visit to meet Father Christmas.
Right, OK. Yeah.
Well, to begin with, I was a bit sceptical, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, hang on, mate, I think you'll find that Father Christmas is a mythical, fictitious character.
Uh-huh.
But then he showed me a photo.
A photo?
Of him and Father Christmas. Apparently it was taken when Father Christmas was over in London visiting this guy and shopping in Harrods. They really did mate. This guy from the pub was sitting on Father Christmas's knee, you know. So obviously it was too good a chance to miss, you know, meet Father Christmas and everything. Just for £100. That was it. Oh, yeah, and I had to fetch a suitcase back through Gatwick on my baggage allowance.
What was in his suitcase?
Oh, just souvenirs. He told me I wasn't to look in it, but I'm a bit curious, you know, so I had a peek. And the whole suitcase was full of Lapland snow. All wrapped up in little plastic bags. And apparently it's very special, Lapland snow. It's very magic snow.
Magic snow. So let me get this straight, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
You went all the way to Lapland for a weekend in December.
Yeah.
It was too dark and cold to see anything.
Right.
You carried a suitcase full of magic snow back through customs.
Yeah.
And the reason you went was to visit Father Christmas.
Yeah.
You're so gullible, Nick. If it was December, Father Christmas isn't going to be there, is he? Sleigh with Donna and Blitzen for Christmas Eve, wouldn't he? Practicing.
Of course. God, I'm so stupid sometimes, aren't I? I'll tell you another example of how stupid I am. Have you seen that advert on the telly where there's like a phone ringing with a lizard on it, you know, and there's this girl in the window in like silk underwear?
Yeah, I know the one.
The first time I saw that advert, do you know what I thought? I thought it was something to do with chocolate.
Of course it isn't, Nick. It's an advert for oral sex,
yes,
isn't
I know.
It?
Now.
Two things separate the human race from the rest of creation. One is its unique ability to behave embarrassingly at wedding receptions. The other is the marvel that is the mind. The human mind is more powerful and more sophisticated than even the most advanced computer. Unlike the human mind, a computer cannot formulate abstract ideas or create philosophical argument. On the other hand, it cannot get an irrational fear of Daddy Longlegs or forget the name of the third brother in Bonanza. Not Hoss or Little Joe, but the other one. Nonetheless, the human mind is fantastically powerful. It can convince someone in a meditative trance that their body is floating, defying the laws of gravity. It can convince an Indian fakir that a bed of hot coals is in fact a cool grassy lawn. It can even convince Jenny Seagrove that Michael Winner is attractive. It can control reality. Dr. Sarah White, a psychiatrist, explains.
Well, this is an experiment to show the power of the mind. Under hypnosis, I have told this patient that he is, in fact, a white rhino. And as you can see, he is grazing just like a rhino and rubbing his back against a tree like a rhino.
Mm. Why is his face so flat?
Ah, that's from where he keeps ramming my Land Rover.
The little that we do know about the mind we owe to pioneers like Jung and his followers. Carl Toms is an Australian psychiatrist who adopted a German accent for career reasons.
Well, the thing is, sport, Jung argued that the human race shares all its past experiences in what he called its racial memory cover. This means that in 200 years' time, people will experience unexplained attacks of panic whenever they hear the words Bonnie Langford. All humans share this racial memory, apart from Kurt Waldheim, of course, who remembers nothing today.
But of course, the greatest explorer of the mind was Sigmund Freud. In 1912, Freud delivered a controversial lecture to the Royal Society of Medicine.
Charlatan!
But yes, I do believe that deep in the subconscious mind, all men want, like Oedipus, to kill their father and sleep with their mother.
Balderdash, sir, I for one am positive I have no hidden urge to sleep with my mother.
How can you be so sure?
Have you seen my mother?
Freud had made a big mistake in formulating his theory of the Oedipus complex. He had not allowed for ugly mothers. He was heartbroken, but he pursued his research, though his theories were constantly rejected. Indeed, it was to be 62 years before his theory of infantile sexuality was finally proved by the arrival of Bruss. Nowadays, of course, the study of the mind is recognized as a major science. What would Freud say if he was alive today, apart from, "Someone get me out of this coffin"? We shall never know. Just as we shall never fully understand the marvel that is the mind.
Well, of course, this year marks the anniversary of Mrs. Thatcher becoming Prime Minister. This year it will be 30 years since she came to power.
No, Nick, she hasn't been in power 30 years.
No?
No, hmm. 20 years, isn't it?
Well, anyway, a lot of critics have remarked that because she's been in power so long, satire has become sterile and predictable.
So, we thought we'd make that the subject of tonight's discussion. Is satire dead? And to discuss it, we have long-time satirist Ned Sherring.
Good evening.
Writer and critic Sheila Black.
Good evening.
And a man with no sense of humour.
Good evening.
Now, Ned, is satire dead?
No, I don't think so. I think, at its best, something like Spitting Image follows on from a satirical tradition that stretches back as far as Pope, Swift, and the caricatures of Hogarth.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, how would you define satire?
Well, satire is the weapon that we use to diminish the threat we feel as individuals from the establishment.
Mm-hmm. And finally, turning to you, man with no sense of humour, what would you define as satire?
Well, I like a good laugh as much as the next man. But I watched Spitting Image the other week, and there was a bit where Norman Tebbit took a plank of wood and knocked Neil Kinnock's head off. Now, how would the writer of that joke feel if I came round to his house with a plank of wood and knocked his head off? Would he think that was funny? I very much doubt it. I think he'd be jolly cross.
Yeah, but wasn't that joke just pure slapstick?
Maybe, but the public are very impressionable. Before you know it, they'll all be out decapitating each other with planks of wood just because Spitting Image told them it was funny. And then there's Ben Elton. Now, I've seen Mr. Elton perform, and I love a good joke, as I think anyone in the office would tell you. But Mr. Elton does a lot of jokes about Mrs. Thatcher, and what I'd say to Mr. Elton is, Mr. Elton. It's very easy to criticise the Prime Minister, but do you think you could do any better? I mean, he's had no experience of being Prime Minister, so he should just keep jolly well quiet.
I think we've just been affirming how subjective a thing humour is. I mean, who's to say who's right and who's wrong?
I am.
But you don't seem... You don't seem to find anything amusing. I mean, who makes you laugh?
Flanders and Swan...
Right.
..made me smile. Once. Almost.
Right, well, thank you, man with no sense of humour. Next week we'll be discussing art with George Melly, David Hockney and a man who thinks a tree should look like a tree. Some sports news now.
A late football result just in. Wimbledon against Mandela United. Match abandoned.
And now a £1 million radio show exclusive, leaked to us by a disillusioned civil servant.
Which narrows it down to about 40,000.
Here's a tape of the meeting of the top brains in the Conservative Party.
Which narrows it down to 4.
All right, everyone, settle down. We all know why we're here. It's our job to decide who should become Prime Minister in the event of Mrs. Thatcher suddenly dropping dead.
Okay? Oh, God forbid.
Absolutely. Well, who's going to start the ball rolling?
Well, it's simple. We want someone, A, with backbone, who, B, hasn't alienated the Prime Minister.
Mutually exclusive. I'm a radio... Let's face it, the Cabinet's got more arse-lickers than a pack of wild dogs, isn't it? Yeah.
What about Kenneth Baker?
Yeah, very funny, but we must get on.
What about Sir Geoffrey Howe?
Very good. Let's leave the jokes till later, okay? Any serious suggestions?
Well...
Yes?
No.
Yeah. Tricky one, isn't it? Yes, Peter.
Well, Sir Henry, we've been doing a little bit of research into this at Central Office, and this may sound contentious... But our research shows that in the event of Mrs. Thatcher's untimely death, her natural and most effective successor would be the dead Mrs. Thatcher.
A dead head of government? You're not serious?
The Americans had one for 8 years. And the Belgians have never had anything else.
Yes.
But in this country, we'd never get away with anything so outrageous.
Well, we got away with Westland.
Yes, we did. Yes. But how will people react to a Prime Minister who's dead?
Well, of course, under the new Official Secrets Act, they need never know.
Oh, yeah.
We're not obliged to tell them anything, but we think we should. There are positive advantages to a dead Mrs. Thatcher.
Well, of course. Mm.
Yes, absolutely.
No, I meant political advantages.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Yes.
First of all, we can deflect trenchant criticism with the "how dare you speak ill of the dead" card.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, in a funny kind of way, we might even make her seem more human, you know, finally admitting she had a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Well, the civil servants won't work for a dead PM.
Oh, I don't know about that. Don't forget there's a deep-seated phobia in Whitehall that Thatcher is immortal. Which means that they'd keep carrying out her policies indefinitely just in case she was pretending to be dead just to catch them out.
Oh, yes. Yes, hang on. But if she's dead, I mean, how could she possibly debate issues and listen to other points of view? Sorry, I'm being silly. I'm sorry. Forget it.
You see, it's all perfectly feasible.
Yes, I think he's right.
Yes, it's foolproof. Perfect.
Yeah, it just won't work, will it? Think about it. I mean, look, what about the next election? Are you seriously suggesting the British people would rather vote for a dead Prime Minister than for Neil Kinnock or Paddy Ashdown? You're right, it'll work, won't it? It will work.
Another £1 million radio show exclusive. Next week, secret tapes of Edwina Curry copulating with the Archbishop of Canterbury. What?
Oh, I see what's happened. I'm terribly sorry, listeners. You see, Frances, who types the sketches, got a bit bored yesterday, and she's obviously just stuck that one in the script to liven up her day. I'm sorry.
She's actually stuck quite a few in the script, Andy.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Well, the one about Colin Moynihan being used as a novelty vibrator isn't bad, is it?
Probably couldn't broadcast it.
No. Well, not unless you took out the bit about Princess Michael.
Yeah. That bit there, That's not physically possible, is it?
No. Anyway, it wouldn't keep still while you did it, would it?
No.
We'd better get on.
Well, we can't. She's done 12 pages of this smut. Look, we can't say any of this, can we? Look at these punchlines.
Yeah.
No, that's the blender. You're right, it is chocolate mousse. I suppose a duck's out the question.
The typing's not getting any better either. Look at these. Look. Do you mind lying still while I have one? That's nice. No, nurse, that's his ear.
Yeah. Right. Look at this one. She may be a sheep, but I tell you, she's the horniest... No, you're right, we can't say anything. And now something else. Anything.
You want to know how I lost this leg? I'll tell you how I lost this leg. We was a-whaling off the coast of Newfoundland when I spots this great white whale off the port bow. And I says, there's the white devil, boys. And we leapt into the canoe and started rowing her through the angry crashing waves towards the demon. We rowed till our lungs felt like they'd burst. Then suddenly, he roared up beneath us, splintering the boat like matchwood. And as we tumbled through the air, I felt the spike of a flashing harpoon tear through my leg. And I felt the blood gush forth as I fell back into the angry sea. My body broken and my leg torn asunder by the great white demon whale. So, when people ask me how I lost my leg, I tell them, that's how I lost my leg.
I'm sorry, but that still doesn't qualify you for disability benefit. Sorry, Captain Ahab. Next.
We present Moby Dick. The story so far. Having been spurned by the DHSS and after a humiliating winter playing left-back for Birmingham City, Captain Ahab, fired by the lust for revenge, set sail once more in search of Moby Dick in his ship, the Pequod. It was the Peapod, really, but the ship's painter was dyslexic. As the voyage drags on, Ahab's growing insanity is chronicled by the narrative figure of Ishmael.
There was excitement amongst the crew that day. Captain Ahab had called a meeting on the deck.
All right, you sea dogs. I knows you for what you are. You scum. The dregs of the human race, detritus, lowest of the low, verminous, putrescent filth.
He's a great motivator, isn't he? Learnt all that on a management training course, apparently.
Shut up! Now then, if you men do right by me, there's gold on this voyage. As sure as my name's Captain Ahab.
His real name's Dominic.
Shut up!
Used to be a hairdresser.
Bolson, have that man whipped till he's light and fluffy, and then serve him up as a meringue. Woo! Now then, lads, we're a-hunting a great white whale. And the first man that spots this great white whale gets this gold doubloon I've nailed to the mast.
Oh, look, there he is, the great white whale.
Where?
Oh, he's gone now, never mind. Still, I get the doubloon nailed to the mast, don't I?
Nearly. Remove the words, the doubloon, from that last sentence.
I get nailed to the mast, don't I?
Correct! And that be a lesson to any other scurvy swab who tries to trick Captain Ahab.
And with those chilling words, Ahab stomped below deck to have his wooden leg chemically treated for dry rot.
No, you fool, the wooden one!
Weeks passed and we saw no sign of the great white whale. Some of the crew made a huge white inflatable whale and tried pulling it behind the ship. But Ahab wasn't fooled. He cut their throats and threw them to the sharks. But the sharks wouldn't touch them as they felt Ahab had taken the skill out of it. 1 month later, northwest of Baffin Island.
All right, you bunch of sea lice, I hear a talk of quitting. Well, we're not giving in. Not till we hunt down the great white devil whale. Hunt him down and kill him, like he killed a human spark inside me. That accursed, damned great white whale.
You do know whales are an endangered species, don't you?
What?
Whales. They're an endangered species. I mean, do we have the right, morally, to hunt them?
What's your name?
His name was Abraham, and he was the only Greenpeace member on board. We marvelled at how he defied Ahab.
We shouldn't hunt whales. It's barbaric.
All right, all right, all right. We'll stop hunting whales.
Splendid.
Except for scientific purposes.
Scientific purposes?
Scientific whale 'em. We'll catch 'em, cut 'em open, chop them up, and then study all the bits.
No, I'm sorry, it's just not good enough.
The man's fortitude filled us with admiration. He was resolute. He was defiant. He was nailed to the mast. Months passed, and then one day,
there she was on the starboard bow! The great white whale!
We've got him into the canoes, you rabble and rogue!
We rowed like fury towards the great white monster. Then suddenly, he attacked, surging up beneath the canoe like the devil himself. The air filled with the screams of dying men. I saw the whale's dreadful eye fix on the broken form of Captain Ahab. Ahab's last words rang out through the air.
All right, you great white devil! I'm prepared to call it quits if you are.
Ahab disappeared from view. He was gone. I clung in agony to a piece of wreckage, and as I floated in that eerie stillness with men's shattered bodies lying in the water beside me and the sea turning red with blood, I thought about man's absurd, destructive folly. I thought of Ahab and his lust for revenge. I thought of the waste of human life, and most of all I thought, this is the last time I come on one of these P&O mystery cruises.
And you can hear the final episode of Moby Dick, when the great white whale is killed by Japanese fishermen, on the grounds that it's a living animal and they are Japanese, next week on Radio 4.
Thank you very much. That's it for this week. Next week we'll be revealing how Keith Richards has actually been dead since 1966, but he's just too stoned to notice.
And we'll be looking at muggings on the tube. Do they at least take the boredom out of the waiting? Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel and featured Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacob. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.